Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where I shall again be continuing my story of the career of Pompey and Caesar in unison, going along parallel. And so if you remember last time we left off that narrative, Pompey, Caesar and Crassus had basically just formed the first triumvirate. And they went out on the steps of the Senate House or the Forum and declared it to the people that they were going to basically push through legislation essentially against the will of the oligarchical senatorial class. So I'll pick up the story there and we shall use more than one source this week, but I shall start with Plutarch, basically exactly where we left off for a bit of an attempt at continuity. So Plutarch says, quote, Caesar went on to gain a still further hold over Pompey's power and influence. He had a daughter, Julia, who was engaged to Servilius Capio, and he now engaged her to Pompey. Apparently they were quite close to getting married. He just sort of ripped her away from him. And he's got no real say in it, this Servilius Capio. Gives her to Pompey. And Pompey's older than Caesar. Pompey's like 5-6 years older than Caesar. So he's way older than Julia. You might have thought Julia might be a bit annoyed about it. We don't really know for sure. But essentially, she didn't seem to mind. They actually seemed to get on quite well. I guess she liked older men. Well, their relationship wasn't just a complete prison for her. Put it that way. And he now engaged her to Pompey, saying that he would arrange that Servilius could marry Pompey's daughter, though she too was engaged already, having been promised to Faustus, the son of Sulla. And shortly afterwards, Caesar married Calpurnia, a daughter of Piso, and got Piso elected as consul for the following year. Quick word on the Piso family. I haven't really mentioned them much, or maybe even at all, but they're one of the really, really most important families. I mean, they're up there with the Claudians. In fact, and if you know about Roman history, different Pisos pop up all over the place, over hundreds of years. they're really a very, very long enduring family. There's lots and lots of Pisos, and obviously they're not always the same guy. In fact, the Piso family was one of the last families to finally get completely wiped out. And that's in a few hundred years from now. Most of the noble families are all gone within 150 years, certainly 200 years of this point, apart from the Pisos. The Pisos continue on for another 100, 150 odd years after that. So they're a very important family. So they will come up as and when I continue this narrative into the imperial period. Plutarch continues. At this, Cato violently protested and exclaimed that it was an intolerable state of affairs to have the government prostituted by marriage alliances and to see men pushing each other forward to high positions and the commands of provinces and armies by the means of women. End quote. If you remember, Cato had refused a marriage proposal from Pompey for exactly that reason. Pompey had offered him his daughter or someone in his family. Cato had said, no, I don't want you to be able to have any sort of sway or hold over me, even if it's just through a woman. I don't accept that. I need to be completely my own man. So when he sees everyone else doing it, forming all these family alliances, Cato doesn't like it. Plutarch goes on. As for Caesar's colleague Bibulus, I mentioned last time, or two epochs ago, that this Bibulus was not on board with Caesar, Pompey and Crassus's plan for government. He was Cato's creature. So he's basically a thorn in Caesar's side, because he can, as in the other consul, he can veto all sorts of things and he can just be a fly in the ointment massively. So Plutarch says, as for his colleague Bibulus, so far from having any success in his efforts to obstruct Caesar's legislation, he, and Cato with him, was often in danger of being killed in the Forum. So he shut himself up in his house and stayed there for the rest of his term of office. He was just intimidated into never turning up. In Roman politics, that's a thing, before this time and after. If you've got high office, you can just stay at home. There is that. It's almost a shorthand for being intimidated into doing absolutely nothing. Such and such stayed home, stayed in his house. And so Bibulus is a classic example of that. Plutarch again. And Pompey, directly after his marriage, filled the forum with armed men and helped the people to pass Caesar's laws and to give him, as his consular province to be, held for 5 years, Gaul on both sides of the Alps, together with Illyricum and an army of 4 legions. Cato attempted to speak against these proposals, but Caesar had him led off to prison. He imagined that Cato would appeal to the tribunes, but he walked on his way without saying a word, and when Caesar saw that not only were the nobility displeased, but the people too, out of respect for Cato's good qualities, were following him in silence and with downcast eyes, he himself privately asked one of the tribunes to get him released, end quote. So that's actually a fairly important little set of events there. Okay, so Pompey's filled the forum with soldiers. So, right, there's no real free politics or debate anymore, at least for a while. You know, if you were going to be harsh, some might say harsh, some might just say realistic, it's a police state then at that point. I mean, Pompey doesn't keep soldiers in the forum every single day going forward forever now, but still, at this point, you know, it's like Charles I bringing soldiers into the House of Commons, or Oliver Cromwell later bringing soldiers into the House of Commons. Yeah, you're going to do as the power of the day demands. It's as simple as that. But Cato, fearless Cato, the ultimately principled Cato, still won't shut up and be cowed. So Caesar has him arrested and led away. Now, that's not the first time Cato has pulled that exact trick. You know, before when he's tried to filibuster, he's been taken away into prison briefly, very briefly. You know, not put on trial or anything, but just stopped from doing whatever he's doing politically in the Senate at that moment. Just prevented from doing that. It's not like he's under arrest forever or anything. But so Caesar at this particular juncture obviously feels he has to do that again. But even he realises that it's really bad politically. It's a really bad look that Cato doesn't even bother before when this is done. Cato's hollered and shouted all the way out of the forum, all the way down the road, hollering and shouting to his people, you know, what injustice is being done to me? How dare they do this? This time he's just quiet. It's like if you've ever done something really bad and your parents don't scream and shout at you. They're just so disappointed. They don't really say anything. You can see it on their ashen faces. Cato sort of pulls that trick. And it kind of works. It seems like it works because, as I read there, Plutarch says, everyone, lots and lots of the people, obviously feel solidarity with him and go along with him. And Caesar can read the room. That's one of the things Caesar's great at, is reading people, reading a room, reading a situation, reading a battlefield. He can see it. He knows he's gone too far. So he sort of reverses himself quite quickly on that. Plutarch continues, out of the whole number of senators, only a very few used to attend the meetings presided over by Caesar. So most of the senatorial class are just boycotting politics from that point onwards. The rest showed their hatred for his proceedings and stayed away. There was a very old senator called Considius, who told Caesar that his colleagues did not come to these meetings because they were afraid of his armed soldiers. Then why, said Caesar, aren't you equally afraid, and why don't you stay at home? Because, said Considius, old age has deprived me of fear. I do not have to give much consideration to the little amount of life that is still left to me. Plutarch again. But the most disgraceful political action of the time was considered to be the election to the tribuneship during Caesar's consulship of Clodius. Remember Clodius Pulcher, the man who had attempted to seduce his wife and who had broken in on the secret nocturnal ceremonies, and also the other main leading light in the Popularis faction, remember. Clodius was elected in order that he might dispose of Cicero, and Caesar did not set out on his campaign until, with the help of Clodius, he had raised a party against Cicero and driven him out of Italy. I'd like now to move over to Appian and read you basically the same bit of history, but from Appian. We can see where there's slightly different details and gives us different things that happened. And I always think it's great. It really is great to compare and contrast different sources. That way, maybe, hopefully, you might be able to get a little bit closer to what really might have happened. So Appian says, quote, in addition, Caesar made the people take an oath to regard the laws as permanently binding and ordered the Senate to do the same, all the laws that he was passing at that time, basically, giving himself and Pompeian Crassus various privileges and commands and things. When Cato and many others resisted, Caesar proposed a death penalty for anyone who failed to swear, and the assembly confirmed this. The tribunes and everyone else were frightened into taking the oath forthwith. A further opposition was pointless when the law had been approved by the others. One Vettius, an ordinary citizen, suddenly appeared in public with a drawn sword and maintained that he had been sent out by Bibulus, Cicero and Cato to murder Caesar and Pompey, and that he had been given his sword by Postumius, one of Bibulus's lictors. From either side's viewpoint, the business was suspicious, and Caesar inflamed the feelings of the mob, and they postponed questioning Vettius until the next day. He was put under guard in the prison and was murdered in the night. All kinds of speculation were rife, but Caesar persisted in alleging that this too had been done by those who were afraid of him, until the people agreed with him to protect those who had been the intended victims of the plot. Bibulus then abandoned everything as though he were a private citizen and did not emerge from his house for the whole of the rest of his magistracy. For his part, Caesar made no further investigations into the Vettius affair, now that he was the sole holder of political power. Apart from introducing laws to win the favour of the mob, he also confirmed all Pompey's acts as he had promised him. Pompey had wanted that ever since he'd returned from the East. If you remember, Pompey had returned from the East and immediately asked the Senate, essentially under Cato, to just rubber stamp everything he'd done and was denied. This is a while ago now. Finally, it's part of the pact of the First Triumvirate. Finally, he gets what he wants. That's the one of the major things Pompey wanted out of this whole secret, semi-secret First Triumvirate. And Caesar does it for him, does push it through. Appian again. The equestrian class, whose status is intermediate between that of the people and that of the Senate, were extremely influential on every question thanks to their wealth. The contracts they leased from the state for the collection of imports and taxes due from the subject peoples, and the large number of highly committed staff that they employed for this purpose. They had for some time been questioning the Senate to remit part of the tax that they had contracted for, but the Senate kept postponing its response. Caesar, who was by now bringing no business to the Senate, but dealing only with the Assembly, gave them a rebate of a third. Thus the equestrian class, the extremely rich and getting richer business class, loved Caesar for that, basically. Because they had received a favour which went far beyond what they had expected, they began to worship Caesar. And so by this one act of politics, he acquired the support of another body of defenders, and one more powerful than the people. He also put on shows of wild beast hunts beyond his means, borrowing money for everything, and outdoing all previous performances in the lavishness of his preparations and the splendour of his gifts, in return for which he was appointed to govern Cisalpine and Transalpine Gaul for a period of 5 years and given 4 legions to command. End quote. So as you can tell, I'm working up to the point where Caesar goes off to Gaul. Now, anyone who doesn't know, hopefully it's not too much of a spoiler alert, even if you've seen some of my previous epochs, you'll know that Caesar actually ends up in Gaul, fighting in Gaul, for 10 years. He's given himself a command there of 5 years. And when that's up, the First Triumvirate award him basically another 5 years. So he's actually out there for 10 years. And there's all sorts of adventures, as you can imagine. And in fact, we've even got Caesar's account of it. You can buy it in Penguin paperback. Caesar's Conquest of Gaul. Now, what I plan to do is maybe next episode, but certainly no more than 2 episodes time, I'm going to take an episode out and just talk all about that. Because it is such a fantastic story and there are so many adventures and daring do and reverses and battles and all sorts of heroics go on and crimes. Some say it goes even as far as genocide. So anyway, lots and lots of events, important and interesting and horrifying events. It deserves an epoch of its own, absolutely. So I'm going to do that. So, but for this episode, I'm going to move along from that. Basically, around this point, soon after this, Caesar leaves the picture of politics in Rome, the scene of Rome itself. And so, because this series is supposed to be about Pompey and Caesar, Pompey's going to take centre stage quite a lot more. Okay, now let me read to you from Suetonius, another ancient historian, Suetonius. Quick word to say on Suetonius, he's got quite a bad rep, really, for being an ancient historian. some people actually think he's bad. He's bad. He's like an unreliable source. I don't think so at all. But he has got a reputation as being, how to say it, sort of scandalous. He likes scandal. He's much less interested in battles and grand strategy, and he's interested in gossip and rumour and scandalous things. So some people, some very serious scholars, think look down on him a bit, look down their nose on Suetonius' accounts. Nonetheless, he is still one of the great sources. But I do need to point out, because I know there will be some people in the comments, certainly on YouTube, just saying, you can't trust anything Suetonius says. Suetonius is a hack. He's like a tabloid journalist version of ancient history. Nonetheless, I won't go quite that far, but you know, there is an element of that to Suetonius. In other words, he might be exaggerating things often. He probably is exaggerating all sorts of things to make it more scurrilous, to make the account more interesting, really. Because even in his lifetime, he was trying to sell books, manuscripts. And one way to do that is to be sensationalist. But okay, Suetonius tells us this, quote, Caesar's first act as consul was to rule that a daily record of proceedings in the Senate and before the people should be taken and published. He also revived the obsolete custom of having an orderly walk before him during the months in which his colleagues held the fasces, while the lictors followed behind. Next, he introduced an agrarian law, and when Bibulus delayed its passage by announcing that the omens were unfavourable, he drove him from the forum by force of arms. On the following day, Bibulus lodged a complaint in the Senate, and when nobody dared move a vote of censure or make any observation on this scandalous event, though decrees condemning minor breaches of the peace had often been passed, he felt so frustrated that from then on he stayed at home, satisfying his resentment with further edicts about unfavourable omens, something Caesar can completely ignore. Caesar was thus enabled to govern alone and do very much as he pleased. It became a joke to sign documents in the consulship of Julius and Caesar, rather than Bibulus and Caesar, naming the same man twice, with no men and cognomen. And the lampoon went the rounds. The event occurred, as I recall, when Caesar governed Rome, Caesar, not Marcus Bibulus, who kept his seat at home. See, that's a classic bit of Suetonius. He gives you just a slightly rude, bawdy, jokey couplet that went round Rome at the time. You know, something like that is a bit below Appian. You know, Plutarch very, very rarely gives us things like that. But Suetonius is peppered with things like that. Anyway, let's go on. Suetonius says, Caesar partitioned two districts of Campania, a plain called Stellas that our ancestors had consecrated, and an agricultural district that was farmed on behalf of the Commonwealth among citizens with three or more children, selecting the candidates through commissioners rather than by lots. Again, this is the agrarian land reforms, which the Senate hated and would do anything rather than grant. When the publicans asked for relief, he cancelled one third of their obligations, but gave them frank warning not to bid too high for their contracts in future. That was the equites getting a break. He freely granted all other pleas whatsoever, and either met with no opposition or intimidated anyone who dared intervene. This is classic popularist stuff. No wonder he was the darling of the people. Marcus Cato once tried to delay proceedings by talking out the Senate, but Caesar had him forcibly ejected by a lictor and led off to prison. Lucius Lucullus went a little too far in opposing Caesar's policy, whereupon Caesar so terrified him by threats of legal proceedings that Lucullus fell on his knees and begged his pardon. Good patrician Romans shouldn't need to fall to their knees and beg for mercy from another Roman patrician. See, that sort of thing is where some people really hated Caesar, that he would bring another man of equal rank, or supposedly on paper, essentially equal rank, would bring him to something like that. That's the sort of thing a Greek or Attic king or tyrant or Alexander the Great might do. Demand that someone kneel or bow or prostrate themselves before you. Romans shouldn't need to do that to other Romans. But Caesar here in his year of consulship is really wielding power as something very, very close to an autocrat. Obviously, he has to answer to the other members of the triumvirate, Pompey and Crassus. But beyond that, he is really dominating politics, absolutely dominating politics. And of course, that causes resentment in anyone who it doesn't favour. So the equestrian class and the people love him, but the optimates and the senatorial order loathe him. They already hated him, really, already. And now, of course, he's absolutely their implacable enemy. Suetonius continues, hearing that Cicero had been making a doleful speech in court about the evils of his times, Caesar at once granted the long-standing request of Cicero's enemy, Publius Clodius, to be transferred from patrician to plebeian rank, rushing the measure through at the ninth hour of the very same day. So we said already, didn't we, that Clodius becomes a tribune so that he can attack Cicero. Well, you can only be a tribune if you're a plebeian, i.e. not aristocratic. But Clodius was aristocratic. Not only was he aristocratic, he was the scion of the Claudian family. So he was as aristocratic as it can be, almost. But you can legally, formally, have yourself reduced from a patrician to a plebeian. We even had that in Britain, it's possible. There's an old MP, he's passed away now, Tony Benn, who had a hereditary title, and he renounced it so that he could be an MP. This was back in the 60s, I believe. If you had a hereditary title, you'd have to sit in the House of Lords, but he really wanted to sit in the Commons, so he sort of legally renounced his title. Anyway, Clodius has been asking for this for a while because he's ambitious. He realises that one of, if not probably the best, most efficient path to power for him is through a tribuneship to begin with, but he would have to renounce his patrician standing. And finally, Caesar has got the power as sole consul to do that, and he does. Okay, Suetonius continues. But he rushed the measure through that very same day. Finally, he began an attack on the opposition faction by bribing Vettius to announce that some of them had tried to make him assassinate Pompey. See, Suetonius just flatly says that Vettius was bribed. He's prepared to go with the slightly more scandalous version, as though it's just simply a fact. Whereas, if you remember, a few moments ago, Appian said nobody really knew for sure. And if I'm being a serious historian here, I don't know. So I'll have to say that nobody really knows. Whereas, you know, and again, a classic sign of what Suetonius is, what he's like, that he just says, no, he was bribed. It was a bribe. He goes on.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.